kiss your lips a thousand times, and more times than I can count. I have called you mine. You have stood by me in my
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. Have a lot of positive insights about cheaper food, what it means. Melatonin makes old bones stronger. We're also going to look at about free will seems a matter of mind, not soul, Brown University. That'll be an interesting discussion. We're also going to look at the poor diet before pregnancy is looked to cause more preterm birth. And supplement with magnesium lowers C-reactive protein in pre-diabetics. That could save a lot of lives. Natural asthma relief. So we have a lot more to share on that. Then we're going to take a look at toddlers dosed with speed. How Big Pharma hooks American kids on dangerous meds. From our public health segment. And that's from Arthur Rosenberg from Alternet. Then we're going to look at No Rest for Psychopharma Until Every American Is Drug. Kelly Patricia O'Meara, and that'll be coming up. And then from our environmental segment, we have several. One is a new photo from satellite shows that one of the most important lakes in America, Lake Powell, which is fed by the Colorado, is really drying up. It's amazing. So we'll tell you why that's important, how many people are affected. We've been getting some good economic news. I say, put it in proper context. Good for whom? I'm looking at the same statistics, and I'm finding it's not true. In fact, just the opposite. And I'm going to put this out there now, so that later on when we open our calls for comments, you can share your points of view. Here's the latest statistics. Walmart profit plunges $220 million and store traffic declines 1.4%. Target goes down $80 million, 16% lower than last year. The store traffic declines 2.3%. Sears loses $358 million in the first quarter, and the plunge in stock was 7.8%. Kmart goes down 5.1%. J.P. Penney was only losing $358 million in the quarter. Kohl's operating income plunges 17%. Costco profits decline 84%. Staples goes down 44%. Hundreds of stores to close with Staples. The Gap income drops 22%. And American Eagle profits go down 86%. They're going to close 150 stores. Best Buy sales decline $300 million. Margins decline. Macy's profit is flat. Dollar General profit plummets 40%. Urban Outfitters earning collapsed 20%. McDonald's even fell $66 million as comparable sales fall about 1.7 last year. Darden profit collapses 30% as same restaurant sales plunge even more. Dick's misses earnings expectations. Home Depot misses earnings expectations. Lowe's misses earning expectations. TJX misses earnings expectations. And then they're going to be closing up some of these other stores. So we have two realities, one based upon thousands of people becoming unemployed. How do I make this good news? Who are the people mainly shopping in the places I just mentioned? The wealthy? No. No, these are just working class people, middle class people shop at these stores. So what you have is you have increases in phone, cable, Netflix. That's where people are spending their disposable income because they can do it at home. Now, then you look at higher food prices, so it's more expensive for people to eat out who otherwise might have. if we actually paid them a living wage. Then you throw in bad weather, and so then you have a high unemployment rate, and parents have got to be concerned about their kids, where historically they would have been at summer camp, many can't afford it, summer school, many can't afford it. 92 million working-age Americans don't have a job. That's 92 million adults don't have a job or could work. 47 million are getting some form of welfare, mostly food stamps. They don't want the food stamps, they want jobs. So where then are people supposed to go and buy things if they don't have disposable income and cannot even meet their interest payments? So I'm looking at a different economy than the people on MSNBC and the talking heads and the journalists, the Wall Street Journal and other places. Your thoughts later on in the program about the partial truths and misinformation campaign. Yes, there are parts of our economy that are booming. More wealthy people are making more money, especially billionaires, than ever before in our history. In fact, one single person, not an exception, a billionaire, hedge fund, made more money this year than the Rockefellers, Carnegies, the Roosevelts, the Vanderbilts, the Astors combined. Combined. That's how much he made this year. So when you consider the robber barons, as wealthy as they were, couldn't touch the people today as far as sheer wealth. So we're only looking at those people who are successful. We're looking at those themes and corporations that are making money. We're not looking at everyone else and what it means, what the solutions are. What are the solutions? We'll be going to your calls later at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888 later on in the program. Let's begin. Many people cannot afford to go into some health food stores. They live day to day. Many Americans. We're not talking about a few thousand or 100,000 or even a few million. We're talking about almost 100 million. I'm back on the road filming. I just recently filmed Philadelphia and 3 weeks ago filmed in Camden. And what I'm seeing is that depend upon how much money a person has or food stamps, what they'll buy, and it's a disproportionate amount of what they actually have for food. And they'll think about getting a large jar of peanut butter, for example, something I would not recommend because, A, a lot of people are allergic to peanuts or aflatoxins that are on the soil where peanuts are grown. And it, in and of itself, is not something people should be eating. But ask yourself, where did we encourage public markets? Why not have a cheap food market? Meaning, the state and the federal government allows any, let's say, organic farmer that donates foods that they grow to a common market, and the people who are on lower income can go there and do their shopping and buy healthy items, fresh items, at a substantial discount, probably half of what it would cost them in a regular supermarket. Therefore, we could have these in every city and community in the United States because we have organic farms everywhere. And one of the plights of the farmer is, having some items you're growing that, you're not going to sell. A lot of times they just plow it under or they feed it to the livestock. But what if they grew in order to get a tax relief and therefore it wasn't costing them money, saving them money? In return, the public had a chance to buy healthy, very inexpensive food locally. That's an idea. Here's from the University of Illinois at Urbana. Cheaper food may be fueling U.S. obesity epidemic. Americans spend just one-tenth of disposable income on food. A historical low. Cheaper food leads to an epidemic of obesity. The study found that it's an epidemic that's hitting all Americans, not just certain groups. Quote, not only has food been getting cheaper, but it is easier to acquire and easier to prepare. it's not just that we may be eating more high-calorie foods, we're eating more of all types of food. Yeah, that's true, prepared foods. But if you look at healthy food, you're not going to get overweight eating it. But you start eating the high-protein foods, the deep-fried foods. See, what's happening is we're confusing quality foods. We think that fried chicken is a quality meal, or that a double hamburger is a quality meal, or if you can get it cheaply for a dollar, and you're seeing those advertised now, the dollar meal. Well, yeah, a lot of people are going to eat it, but it's not healthy. It's refined carbohydrates, genetically modified feed going into genetically modified animals, growth-stimulating hormones, antibiotics, pesticides, saturated fat, arachidonic acid. It's bad to the bone. That's what's fueling obesity and heart disease. McGill University has researched melatonin, and they found that it allows for stronger bones, especially old bones become stronger. And that's important, because the older you get, the more likely you are to have brittle bones. And the cells which break down our bones, they're called osteoclasts, are more active at night, while those responsible for bone formation, osteoblasts, are more active during daylight hours. Quote, as we age, we sleep less well, which means that the osteoclasts are more active. This tends to speed up the process of bone breakdown. So, one more reason to get a good night's sleep. But also, when you're taking melatonin, let's say 1 to 2 milligrams, where you're getting a good night's sleep, which secretes that melatonin, then you're helping make sure that your bones are healthy. Now, this is an interesting study from Brown University. It says, free will seems a matter of mind, not soul. Quote, online interview subjects were asked about moral choices and culpability on the part of 5 active agents, from normal human to plain robot. Free will was associated more with the mind, intentional thought, capacity by choice, than with the metaphysics of soul. A new study tested whether people believe free will arises from a metaphysical basis or mental capacity. And even though most respondents said they believe humans to have souls, they judged free will and assigned blame for transgressions based upon pragmatic considerations such as whether the actor in question had the capacity to make an intentional or independent choice. So across the board, even if they believed in the concept of a soul, people in a new study ascribed free will based upon down-to-earth criteria. Did the person in question have the capacity to make a really intentional and independent choice? And the study suggests that while grand metaphysical views of the universe remain common, they have little to do with how people assess each other's behavior. Quote, I find it relieving to know that whether you believe in a soul or not, or have a religion or not, or an assumption about how the universe works, that has very little bearing on how you act as a member of the social community. This was from Professor of Cognitive, Linguistic, and Psychological Science at Brown University. This was published in the online journal Consciousness and Cognition. Here's what I have to say on this. I believe they're confused. They're confused because when you use the word soul, do you understand what it means? Most people would assume that it's some metaphysical presence that we're born with, but they can't define it further. I think it's in the linguistics, and then understanding this. I believe that we are all born of spirit, of vital energy that is all-knowing and all-encompassing, and it doesn't make mistakes. For example, we believe in our society in duality, the good and the evil, the right and the wrong, them and us. Okay, and that's how we end up in conflict. Even when people are both seeking to do something right, if they take such diametrically opposite positions, then they become logger-jammed in conflict. Nothing gets done. We couldn't go to war with someone. We couldn't rob someone. We couldn't hurt someone. We couldn't steal from someone if we honored them, if we found something sacred in them. It's when we demonize someone, when we subject them to being the other, that it's very easy then to be indifferent to them. Look, for example, at what happens in the Holocaust. There were 40 to 50 million Germans. The majority did not belong to the Nazi Party. But there was very little in the way of resistance. The greatest resistance movements came from the Jewish people themselves, the French, and others that fought against this tyranny. The average person just went about their life, knew full well what was going on. There were no secrets, not even the concentration camps. But no one stood up. Now, then when we think about that, we think, well, then they participated in an evil. They were witness to evil. They didn't stand up to it. But then in all societies, we'll have those people who manifest an evil, a genocide, a harm. And depending upon our conditioning, and depending upon free will, we will either address it in some way, or we will deny it or hide from it until after the fact. And then suddenly everyone comes out of the closet with stories to tell. Now show me a single baby that is born a racist. Show me a baby that is born prejudiced. Show me a baby that's born greedy. Show me a baby that is born aggressive and wants to hurt, kill other babies. You won't. They're born with pure spiritual perfection. But then something remarkable happens to the degree that both parents and others continue to participate in honoring the spirituality of that child. They will develop a moral, ethical, a humanistic attitude towards themselves and other people. They will be the conscientious observers of life and participants. They'll be caretakers with a sensitivity to their actions. Hence, they wouldn't want to disrupt nature or to destroy it, just have a shopping center, to have their house on a hill. They wouldn't do that. They wouldn't attack another people, knowing full well that 90% of all casualties in wars are civilians. They would say, what's the difference between a farmer in Russia and a farmer in Kansas? They're, put them together, and you'll see how much they have in common, far more than they don't. Why should one want to hurt the other? And then you think, well, then how did we get in the mess we are today, where all of our institutions, every single institution, has betrayed us? Now, that does not mean that people working in the institution are bad people or negative. It means that we adapt to the circumstances that we're raised in. And when people argue that this couldn't be true, I say that we're born pure. Okay. We know that we have trillions of cells. As you age, you get more cells, but you're born with a lot that you have your whole life. And no one's actually counted every cell in the body, but it's estimated to be between 70 to 100 trillion. Every millisecond of your life, they're working in cooperation for the greater good of your body. Your eyes blink, but you didn't teach it. Your liver digests and cleanses and synthesizes and detoxifies. You didn't teach it any of that. Your stomach will digest a piece of tofu different than a piece of chicken, different than a piece of bread, and different than a cola. It was never taught. Your skin will constrict when it's cold and sweat when it's hot. Where did it learn that? Your heart will beat up when you exercise, slow down when you're not exercising, go to a different rate when you're sitting, and a different rate when you're lying down. How does it know to do that? You can't see the microbe, but you eat one single E. coli, and this body knows it and causes diarrhea. You get a virus, and suddenly your body creates a temperature spike. It does a trillion, 100 trillion different processes every second. And yet, the only thing that's missing when you're dead is your energy. Now, we know that we've never created energy. We've only created ways of using energy. We didn't create solar. We created the collectors of the sun's rays and the converters to make that sun's ray and heat into electricity. We didn't create any of the turbines. We figured out a way that when water runs across at a certain rate and certain velocity and a certain pressure per square inch, it can create a significant power. And then with turbines, we create water, hydroelectric. Enrico Fermi split the atom, but he didn't create the atom. So we confuse what we do with the origin. Now, wherever this origin is, you only know that when you pass. Everything else is simply a guess, which is fine. But when you realize how ethical, how moral, how positive, how giving, nurturing, how compassionate that authentic self is, then any time we do something that is wrong, and we know it's wrong, because that mirror is reflecting back at us. Now, we can try to disguise it, justify it. We all create our multiple stories of our own reality that justify us doing something to someone else or taking advantage of someone or something because. These are just excuses. And the more we do, the more we remove ourselves from the authentic self. Then one day we're so far removed, we don't even remember what it was like to be in that spiritual mind space. And so one day you wake up and you realize because of your effort to achieve something, your effort to have something, your effort to possess something, and why? Because more often than not, early in life, you were told or conditioned or motivated or inspired to overachieve because it gave you some reward. And the more you achieved, the higher your level of achievement, the more reward you were given. Unless you're just a natural life energy, and there are some, creative assertives, dynamic aggressives, dynamic assertives, there are always going to be no boundaries to their creativity. It's to their natural inclination. But for the majority of people, when you motivate them constantly to realize there's a reward, you're going to get more love, you're going to get more, then it becomes almost second nature. So one day they're just working themselves to death. And they're making decisions that in normal circumstances, if they were not stressed, if they were not insecure at their core, if they were not coming from a place of emotional pain and withdrawing where they don't get some kind of recognition, emotional recognition, the people that constantly need emotion. But it's a bottomless pit. No matter what you give them, it drains out. They got to have it again and again and again. And one day a person wakes up and says, there's something wrong with my life. And sometimes it takes an economic crisis, a health crisis, a relationship crisis, an aging crisis, something that just slams the brakes on. And you think, wow, was I just texting on with one hand, on the cell phone with the other, and with my eyes off the road, and I almost hit something. And then there's that realization that you weren't paying attention to your own life, what is really important in your own priorities. Then and only then will most people get it. After all, why do you have to change? Turn on Oprah, Dr. Phil each day, or Dr. Oz. They'll tell you your truth, and you'll be able to live through them. Buy their magazines. What kind of narcissism has a person showing their face on every single cover of a magazine that Oprah does? But that's the reality. She's like any other cult. She has her followers, and they swear by her, and that's what they'll do. But will they go out and turn it off and have their own life? Show me the examples. We have become a commercial spiritual endeavor, and we've missed the authentic. So when we get back to what is authentically spiritual, we have a completely different vitality because it connects with other people and what's real, and then you become independent. And I don't believe you can connect with the spiritual authentic self until you are independent in your thinking. I haven't seen it, except in those independent thinkers. Those are just some thoughts based upon my perception of the Brown University. Academia just missed so much of the truth. My God, they're outside of the real world. Finally, from the University of Adelaide in Australia, a poor diet before pregnancy linked with preterm birth. And they took a look at 300 South Australian women to better understand their eating habits before pregnancy. It was the first study to actually assess women's diets prior to conception, and then the outcomes. The results were published in the Journal of Nutrition show that women who consistently ate a diet high in protein and fruit prior to becoming pregnant were less likely to have a preterm birth, while those who consistently ate high-fat, sugary foods and takeaway were junk foods were 50% more likely to have a preterm birth. Quote, preterm birth is a leading cause of infant disease and death and occurs in approximately 1 in 10 pregnancies globally. Anything we can do to better understand the conditions that lead to preterm birth will be important in helping improve survival and long-term health outcomes for children. That's according to Dr. Jessica Greiger, at the research fellow at the Institute. So we should be having centers in every community in the United States. I believe we should have one large center broken into different divisions, each separate. One would be to help people who are in life crisis. One would be to help those who are in health crisis, those who are coming off addictive behaviors, drugs, alcohol, sugar, whatever it may be, and those who are in need of someone to guide them through their problems to get to a solution, because we have nothing but massive bureaucratic gridlock in our society. And a lot of people just don't try to get help because it's so difficult. So if we had one of those, first we'd put some gainfully employed people, and secondly, we'd be helping a lot of people. And I believe that people need that help, and we have a responsibility to help them. I'm Gary Nall. That's our health nutrition updates, just a few things on environmental issues, and then we'll take a break, come back for our guests, and then take your calls a little later on. This is from our environmental segment today. It's from Stephanie Pappas, and here's what it says. Quote, the muddy Colorado River moves through the dry bed of northern Lake Powell. The mud-choked Colorado River flows through a dry lake bed, and new satellite image released yesterday showed that the western drought has left this reservoir on the border of Utah and Arizona less than half full. The satellite image captured on May 13th reveals the lake was at 42% of capacity, according to the Bureau of Reclamation. Now, why is it important? Because it supplies both water and electricity for 20 million Americans. That's where they get their water to drink. And it produces 4.5 billion kilowatt hours of hydroelectricity a year. And all that is changing radically. So here is the takeaway message. We've been told that, yes, there will be some unusual weather events, but not to worry, because, stay put, things will change for the better. A, last year there were over 12,000 exceptional weather events, meaning the worst of its kind, record-breaking in the United States alone. It's not getting better, it's getting worse, and will get a lot worse. So by not telling people you're running out of water in 20 states in the United States, and some of these communities will be out of water within the next 3 months to a year. Over 400 communities in western southern Texas will be out of water in the next 6 months. In California, over 400 communities will be out of water within the next year. And there's no water coming to these people. So there's no effort being made to address the problem. So I just believe it's time that we awaken to the reality that we better pay attention to our environment. And finally, this is from Toddler's Dose with Speed from Martha Rosenberg from Alternet. Quote, a report from the CDC last week confirmed what many have suspected. More than 10,000 2-year-olds to 3-year-olds in the United States are being dosed with Ritalin and Adderall, quote, for ADHD disorder. You heard me right. There is no medical basis for doing this at all. This is complete medical quackery. It is my personal belief that every doctor that gives a 2-year-old Ritalin should be challenged and have their license revoked. The American Academy of Pediatrics guidelines for ADHD, quote, do not even address the diagnosis in children 3 and younger, let alone the use of the supplement medications. That's according to the New York Times, especially because, quote, hyperactivity and impulsivity are developmentally appropriate for toddlers, meaning kids are happy and sad, they're active in their sleep. Toddlers on Medicaid are especially targeted for ADHD meds, commensurate with Big Pharma's heisting of government funds as its main source of revenue, a marketing plan also seen with Medicare and VA prescriptions. Why does the richest nation in the world have so many children afflicted with ADHD and conduct disorders and depression and spectrum disorders and oppositional defiant disorders and mixed manias and social phobia and bipolar disorder? There's no science. For those of you who joined me about a month ago when we protested at the American Psychiatric Association's annual meeting, you saw that I offered a challenge to the psychiatrist there. Bring your evidence, scientific proof, that these are real disorders that you can measure objectively. And you also know there is no such evidence anywhere. And they're honest about it, at least. They'll tell you, well, it's all subjective. Well, it's all subjective. And there's no difference between a placebo and a toxic drug. Why not just give a placebo? Because they don't make a profit from that. Also, here's the bottom line. Children are good customers. Quote, children are known to be compliant patients, and that makes them a highly desirable market for drugs. That was Gwen Olson, who I filmed. She was the author of Confessions of a Rx Drug Pusher. Quote, children are forced by school personnel to take their drugs. They are forced by their parents to take their drugs, and they're forced by their doctors to take their drugs. So, children are the ideal patient type because they represent refilled prescription compliance and longevity. In other words, they will be lifelong patients and repeat customers of Big Pharma, end quote. I did a documentary on this called The Drugging of Our Children. Pathologizing our children for money, in my opinion, is insidious. Psychiatrist Philip Senekin recounts reading a scientific article in which it was debated whether a 3-year-old girl who ran out in traffic had oppositional defiant disorder or bipolar disorder. The latter, by the way, is marked by the grandiose delusions that she was special and cars could not harm her. Stimulants for ADHD are not innocuous. They produce sleep, growth, and appetite problems in children, hallucinations, and other mental problems, and set them up for a lifelong drug use. There's another class of drugs Big Pharma has convinced doctors to prescribe to large groups of children, especially Medicaid children, atypical antipsychotics like Risperdal, Zyprexa. Big Pharma even schmoozed doctors on the golf course to get kids hooked on the dubious drugs. Court documents unsealed in South Carolina show that Eli Lilly's sales reps used golf bets to push Zyprexa. One doctor agreeing to start new patients on Zyprexa, quote, each time a sales representative parred. Texas Medicaid program spent $557,256 for just 2 months' worth of pediatric Egidon, another atypical antipsychotic. In another set of court documents, the drug was not even approved for children at the time. The National Institute of Mental Health study of children 8 to 19 with psychotic symptoms found Risperdal and Zyprexa were no more effective than older antipsychotics. And Moban, which caused such obesity, a safety panel ordered the children off the drugs. In just 8 weeks, children on Zyprexa gained 13 pounds in 8 weeks. And kids on Risperdal gained 9 pounds. Quote, kids at school were making fun of me, said Brandon, who put on 35 pounds while taking one of the drugs. In fact, the atypical antipsychotics caused so much weight gain and diabetes that one person won a $15 million lawsuit from Eli Lilly to recoup medical costs generated by Medicaid patients who who develop diabetes while taking Zyprexa. And the government, our government, bought $717 million for veterans to give them if they have post-traumatic stress disorder. Well, and did it do any good? None of these drugs ever have to do any good. They're there to make money. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. Going to go to the Russian-Canadian investigative journalist Daniel Estulin, author of current very important work on the Bilderberg Agenda, the Council on Foreign Relations, in the context of current events and policies. He's currently living in Spain. We'll be talking with him from Spain. And he's best known as the independent researcher who has infiltrated the agendas and conversations conducted at the infamous Bilderberg meetings. He has a background in military intelligence and has been researching the history and ongoing activities of the Bilderberg Group and other organizations such as the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission for over 20 years. This weekend, the Bilderbergers, a secretive cartel founded in 1954 that includes major bank executives, past and present political figures, industrial leaders, high officials in the national intelligence agencies will conduct their annual meeting in Copenhagen, Denmark. As with all Bilderberg meetings, media coverage of these conferences is completely silenced. Even Bilderberg participants pledge to not discuss any of the conversations at any time following the gathering. And Daniel is the author of the best-selling The True Story of the Bilderberg Group, which is regarded as the most authoritative text about this group that works behind the scenes of our global economy and free market policies. And he's also the host of the most popular television program on Russian TV's Spanish channel, and his website is Daniel, estulin.com. Nice to have you with us today, Daniel.
It's great to be on your show again. Thank you so much for the invitation. Wonderful to be back.
I've had a chance to browse through the proposed agenda of topics to be discussed at this year's Bilderberg Conference, starting this Friday in Copenhagen that you leaked, and also the list of scheduled participants. As might be expected, there's no one from Russia invited this year. There's a heavy dose of people from the national intelligence agencies, Generals Alexander Keith and David Petraeus, the Secretary General of NATO, then the usual dose of free marketeers, neoliberals, Robert Rubin, Larry Summers, the heads of Goldman Sachs, executives from Google, Microsoft, and other high-tech groups. And since last year's conference, there have been some radical changes in the international arena, and I'd like you to address some of them from the standpoint of the Bilderberg strategic position. However, before we look at some of the Bilderberg agenda items, I'd appreciate you drawing the connections between the Bilderberg Group and the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission. Where do these organizations fit with the strategic plans and agendas developed within the Bilderberg cartel?
Organizations such as the Bilderberg Group, Trilateral Commission, Council on Foreign Relations, the Panay Circle, Bohemian Grove, and many other think tanks and foundations, you could call them they're by no means the seats of the levers of power. You can call them the conveyor belts. They're important elements and they have been over the last few decades. But it's silly to think that organizations such as the Bilderberg Group or Trilateral Commission, who, you know, they have their websites and, you know, their Facebook pages, and we actually know, as a result of, you know, within my book has been published, The True Story of the Bilderberg Group, we know who these people are, we know pretty much where they meet. And over the last few years, Bilderberg has actually created their own webpage, so now we actually know the agenda items and the list of participants. But it's important to understand that out of these organizations that you mentioned before, Trilateral Commission, which is America's Europe and Asia, thus Trilateral, was founded by David Rockefeller back in 1973 with Zbigniew Brzezinski, and whose objective was basically to unify under the umbrella of these supranational organizations some of the world policies which were not touched by other organizations. Council of Foreign Relations, that's an American brother to the Bilderbergers. There's about 4,000 members, and they come from all walks of life: finance, industrialists, bankers, politicians, business leaders, members of the financial community, media conglomerates, and so on and so forth. And they were founded back shortly after the end of the First World War. And out of the Bilderberg, you could say that it's the more exclusive. It was founded back in 1954 by Prince Bernard, a Nazi SS card-carrying member, and it includes about 120, 130 participants. And what's interesting is that, again, the people who participate in these meetings, they represent the wealth, you could say, of Western nations. In the case of Bilderberg Group, you have the financiers, again, industrialists, you know, top bankers, top politicians, top business leaders of multinational corporations, presidents, prime ministers. Not the sitting president of the United States, he never attends, but he's well represented by others who speak on his behalf and who take questions and answer, you know, queries from Bilderberg attendees on behalf of the president. But sitting presidents of European nations and Canada usually do attend, because Bilderberg is a former NATO alliance. Other individuals who attend these meetings, you have state secretaries, members of European Union, the commissioners and such, top-ranking executives from the World Bank, International Monetary Fund, presidents of media conglomerates and military leaders, you have people from the Washington Post. Donald Graham usually attends before that. Catherine Graham attended Bilderberg meetings. She was also a member of the Trilateral Commission and the Council of Foreign Relations. You have The Economist is there, Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, the New York Times, Washington Post, Time Magazine, Newsweek, what actually, you know, was meant something way back when. So all of the media is represented there. And what's interesting, you know, is that very little of the information until very recently has ever come out of the mainstream press, specifically because media is invited on the assumption, understanding that what is said at these meetings is never actually revealed in public unless Bilderbergers have their agenda and they want the media to put a particular spin on this thing, because again, media, mainstream media, forms part of the world elite, and needless to say, they're part of this interlocked collage, you would say. But as far as Bilderberg itself is concerned, it was a very important element of the oligarchical structures of the Cold War period. It's a very important element because it meant that it was a vehicle, meetings such as the Bilderberg Group meetings, through which private financier oligarchical interests were able to impose their policies on what is nominally sovereign governments. And as I said before, it was heavily, heavily populated by people who came out of the old World War II Nazi apparatus, such as Prince Bernard, one of the founders of the Bilderberg Group, although there are other people who are far more important as far as the Bilderberg organization itself is concerned. Another individual who is very much linked to the initial Bilderberg meetings back in the 1950s is Walter Hallstein, the first president of the European Commission. He was the Nazi lawyer who actually presented his case, which allowed Hitler as a way out on a legal level to create his red of concentration camps across Europe. So this is the basis of these organizations, but none of them, be it Bilderberg, Trilateral Commission, Council of Relations, they're not the seats of power. The real decision-making process works at a much higher level than Bilderberg or any such other organizations.
All right. Tell us about the Council on Foreign Relations, because here you have a top editor at The Nation magazine that is supposed to represent the liberal perspective, sitting with people who are neocons and who've repeatedly supported our wars and extrajudicial efforts at destabilizing regimes, democratically elected regimes, and most people are not aware of them, what they do.
Yeah, You know, as in a conventional tarot play, there are actually spin-off organizations similar to Bilderberg who play an important role in this, you know, pan-world supranational or scheme to use wealth concentrated in the hands of very few people to exert world control. And the largest, you know, you could say is the Round Table, stemmed from the secret society created by the British magnate Cecil Rhodes to unite the world, beginning with the English-speaking domination, under enlightened elitists like himself. We're talking about going back to the late 19th century. World War I and the post-war proposal for a League of Nations actually resulted from the Round Table cabal's machinations. And this covert network decided to establish across the world front organizations whose branches included Britain's Royal Institute of International Relations, Institute of International Affairs of Canada, Australia, South Africa, India, Holland, as well as Institute of Pacific Relations for China, Russia, and China. And one of the, one of the roundtable's branches in the United States is actually called Council on Foreign Relations. And CFR is the most powerful think tank in the United States, and it is an arm of the Bilderberg Group. It's also the premier U.S. foreign policy think tank in America, and is one of the central institutions for socializing American elites from all major sectors of society, where they literally work together to construct a consensus, the same kind of consensus you'd get at the Bilderberg meetings and CFR meetings and Trilateral Commission meetings, the consensus on major issues related to American imperial interests around the world. And as such, the Council on Foreign Relations often sets the strategy for American policy and wields enormous influence within policy circles where key players often and almost always come from the rank and file of the CFR itself. And if you actually go back and look at, American secret establishment or American establishment, you look at all the presidents, either they were members themselves, as in the case, we can go back to Ford, who was a member of the Bilderberg Group. We can go to Carter, who was one of the founders of the Trilateral Commission. You go to Reagan, who was a member of nothing, but he certainly surrounded himself with over 400 people who were members of Council for Relations, Bilderberg Group, Trilateral Commission, or member of two or three of these organizations. The same can be said for Bush's son, who was not a member of anything, really, except, well, he actually was. I'm not being exactly correct. He was a member of America's most secret society, that's Skull and Bones. His father and his grandfather, Prescott Bush, were also members of Skull and Bones, and that is a secret society founded back in 1832. And there were the American branch, you would say, of the famous Illuminati. But as far as the Bush Jr. Administration, he was not a member of CFR. He was not a member of Trilateral Commission. He was not a member of the Bilderberg Group. But he surrounded himself with over 300 individuals who took over key positions in power within the administration to make sure that the decision-making process stays, within the same circles. Bilderberg, CFR, Trilateral Commission, whose idea hasn't really changed, and that idea, needless to say, has to do not so much with the creation, as we hear too often, frivolously, people talking about one world order, one world government, but rather the concept is different. It's One World Company Limited. Corporations with a far greater power than any government on the planet, and we're seeing this around the world today. We could talk about European politics, European financial politics, banking sector, or we can talk about the world stage where money rules governments in most countries, and even in the United States, the sitting president has very little decision-making power. That power is in the hands of actually people who put him in that White House in the first place.
The question I think is most important at the moment is, I'm seeing the rebirth of fascism that is occurring in Europe. The U.S. support of neo-Nazi groups who have usurped the Ukraine is now well known. However, we've recently seen Le Pen merge strong in France. The pro-Hitler political leader, Voigt, in Germany, also one in Denmark. Right-wing leaders in the Netherlands. Growing popular support for neo-fascist parties in other countries as well. Is there any indication or proof, not speculation, that the Bilderberg and international banking cartel's quest for global economic domination shares a particular alignment with neo-fascist ideologies and causes? And if so, what is that evidence?
Well, you know, it's a very interesting but very complicated question at the same time, because, as I said, Bilderberg was founded itself. The foundation of Bilderberg was pure Nazism, and the people who were key individuals in Hitler's key decision-making apparatus were some of the founding members of Bilderberg, such as the Prince Bernard, one of the founders, the father to Queen Beatrix, now she is Princess Beatrix, or Walter Hallstein, who was, you know, the key Nazi lawyer and one of the key individuals and bureaucrats, you know, for over a quarter century since the beginning of the period of the first Bilderberg meeting back in 1954. That said, what we're seeing today in Europe is very different from how, you know, one understands the word Nazism, because, you know, you see that word being, you know, bandied around a lot. But, for example, the case of Marine Le Pen, the idea is that, or the case of Nigel Farage in England and his United Kingdom Independence Party, these are not Nazi parties. The world today, for example, we're talking about the financial system now, is run by monetary systems, not national credit systems. And if you look at some of the policies of Farage and Marine Le Pen, and I'm not talking about, you know, smaller German parties, but I'm talking about these big parties. You know, their idea is national credit systems. And if you're smart, you don't want a monetary system around the world. You want sovereign nation states to have their own credit system, which is a system of their currencies. That's what, you know, Le Pen and Farage and others want. And above all, the possibility of productive non-inflationary credit creation by the state, which is firmly stated in the United States Constitution, and which was, you know, exactly the reason why it was excluded from the Maastricht Treaty, which actually put together this, you know, union in the first place, as a method of determining economic and financial policies. Now, in Europe, this cannot be done. You cannot have a national credit system in Europe, because in Europe, the governments are subject to control by private banking interests called independent banking system, which is part of this monetary system controls, you know, controlling the entire European bloc. And that's something that all these parties who want out of the European Union, basically they're saying, we want to get back our currency, which is a measure of independence of our nation state. We want back our borders. We want back our constitution. Because in Europe right now, European constitution takes precedence over national constitutions in times of trouble, and we know how easily crisis can be created so that the national constitutions can be usurped in name of whatever it is that they're trying to put forward. And this is basically what you're seeing right now on the European stage. So these institutions in Europe have the power to regulate governments and to dictate terms to government, which is, as we said before, has nothing to do with one world government, but rather the idea is one world company limited, these corporations or banking institutions who literally can dictate terms to elected governments. And if you think about these institutions within this European edifice called European Central Bank, and it tries to function like European Independent Central Bank, which has no government. There's no government. There's no nation. It's a group of nations run by a private bank. And that's something that a lot of these parties, and you could talk about the extreme left-wing party in Greece, which is basically one on the platform of no to austerity, or you could talk about Nigel Farage, you could talk about Marine Le Pen, or you could talk even about, you know, traditional parties on the European stage, such as the Conservatives and the socialists. There are a lot of sane voices in these parties who are saying enough of belonging to Europe, and Spain is a great example. The country has been destroyed. It's no longer a nation state. It's a protectorate controlled by the supranational financial elite. A lot of people in the mainstream parties are saying enough is enough.
I appreciate you coming on and sharing these insights with us. Most people are not aware, though it's completely legal to join these groups. The question is, if these powerful people, including journalists, educators, politicians, industrialists, media conglomerate owners, and academics, and people within the military-industrial complex, the pharmaceutical complex, the energy cartel complex, you get them all together, and they're deciding to make decisions in secret that could impact our lives, that is neither fair nor is it moral. My concern is not what they're doing is legal, but are they changing the world in ways that we do not have any participation or say-so?
That's a very good question. That's an excellent question. And that's often, you know, when people ask me about these societies, how they work, it takes a little while to explain it, but I think the explanation is fairly simple. People have to understand that the decision-making process of these meetings is very important and affects the world over the next 12 to 24 months. That said, it is silly to think that a group of people, I don't care how powerful they are, who actually meet 3 days a year, in a hotel somewhere, you know, be it in Europe or in the United States or Canada, can actually, you know, change the course of history so drastically because they get together 3 days a year. It's not some kind of a wacky conspiracy if you have, you know, four old geezers who sit around the table in a dark room holding hands, staring at a crystal ball, planning the world's domination. The world is a complex place. However, secrecy is certainly, you know, how these people conduct their business behind closed doors. And, you know, if you kind of look at on the world stage, you have the World Economic Forum in Davos in late January, you have the Bilderbergers meet in April or May, you have the G7 meeting also in April or May, then you have the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank annual conference in September, you have the regional meetings of the Trilateral Commission, you have the think tanks, foundations, United Nations, you know, the United States Congress and the Senate, EU commissioners, United European Union summits, government cabinet meetings, so on and so forth. But it's you have a kind of invisible international consensus emerge, and it's carried over from one meeting to the next. But no one is really leading it. There's not this one, you know, eminence Greece who's actually telling everybody else what to do. It's done through consensus, and the consensus becomes the background for the G7 economic policies, and it becomes what informs the International Monetary Fund, what it, you know, imposes an adjustment program on third world nations, and also becomes what the United States President proposes to Congress, what the European Commissioners propose on the Commission level, which becomes European policy, and then that trickles down to national policies across Europe. And, you know, it's indeed from the moment a Bilderberg conference closes, the consensus reached in different areas of discussion at the annual meeting, they're wholeheartedly promoted by these all-powerful political and commercial interests through the mainstream press, while simultaneously becoming common policy to governing international forces of seemingly different persuasions, which is one of the reasons why it's so difficult, you know, the incongruity of how is it that, you know, the left and the right always seem to, you know, have the same policy. How is it in the United States, the Republicans and Democrats,
the only thing that separates them
is their views on abortion.
Daniel, you've given us a great deal of insight. The book is the true story of the Bilderberg Group. The website is danielestulin.com. Daniel, thank you once again from Spain for being on and sharing these insights. That was my guest. I'm Gary Knoll. Now let's go over to our phone because we have standing by Dr. Roy Spicer. And before we go to that, I came up with a really great savings for everyone. I'm going to offer a premium today, a three-month supply, three-month supply of memory stuff. Now, this is the product that contains the magnesium citrate and benfenamine and ginkgo biloba and L-carnosine, by the way, 300 milligrams high, and phosphatidylserine and R-alpha-lipoic acid, and acetyl-L-carnitine, and choline, inositol, cysteine, phenylalanine, glycerol, phosphorylcholine, calcium, B6, B12, B1, vitamin E. It is phenomenal. For people who care about their health, it's called memory stuff. You're getting a three-month supply plus the PBS special I did on reversing brain aging naturally. So that's the premium. All right, healing the brain naturally, plus three bottles for $50. What would be the normal cost of this? It would be up around $170, and I'm not even sure if that includes the DVD. So it's a tremendous savings. Tremendous. I'm not sure. I have to ask my office if that includes the DVD. Otherwise, it'd be well over a $200 value for $50. That's it. Now, I'm going to give you the... So here's what it is. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. You're getting three bottles. Three-month supply of memory stuff. And who couldn't use that in this audience? Plus, Healing the Brain Naturally, the full feature film that tells you everything about brain chemistry and how to reverse a lot of conditions, improve conditions, and prevent conditions. $50. So the three bottles alone, I was told, are $179. That makes the whole package over $200. You're getting it for $50. 877-627-5065. Let's say hello real quick to Roy Spicer. Hi, Roy.
Hi, Gary.
Dr. Roy Spicer is a scientist. He has a background in water chemistry and bacteriology. And he and I had a conversation yesterday because I was concerned about the recent reports of E. coli bacteria outbreaks in Oregon and in Florida drinking water. But that's just the tip of the iceberg regarding waterborne disease outbreaks in the United States. Certainly natural disasters like a Hurricane Sandy can damage water and sewage treatment plants, causing widespread contamination. But then there is the increased occurrence of waterborne disease outbreaks. But according to a recent report from the University of Arizona, published in Review of Environmental Contamination Toxicology, concluded that due to an aging and deteriorating water delivery infrastructure and inadequate disinfection of source water, pathogenic microorganisms that are not properly treated can cause over 264 different waterborne outbreaks, resulting in 574,000 cases of illness and 79 deaths between 1971 and 2002. And the University of Arizona study estimates that there is much more disease impacts that are not reported, which rises into the millions of cases per year. So I wanted Roy to do an analysis of the Gary Null emergency filter to show the water filter system we have, Roy, of what it can do, what it will prevent, and how people can have some peace of mind with it.
Well, first, Gary, after Sandy, thousands of your listeners had the emergency filters and were protected from E. coli and other microorganisms that were found in the sewage water that leaked into the public water systems. This was a major outbreak of waterborne disease. And the filters have been tested in England, and they were tested against 600 million E. coli. And the results were that 100% removal of the E. coli in these filters. They're absolute barriers against waterborne disease caused by E. coli. Plus, they're protective against parasites such as Cryptosporidium and other parasites that are commonly found in drinking water. So the filters that you have available are really an absolute necessity for people who are concerned about waterborne diseases that are either caused by lack of disinfection on a regular basis or particular events such as hurricanes.
Okay. Now, let's just, because we're running into Teresa's show, but I wanted, this was a big concern, people. Tell people what your independent research on the water filtration system does. What does it get rid of? Real quick, Roy.
Well, first, 100% of parasites, 100% of bacteria, such as E. coli, dirt, rust, and sediment. It removes residual chlorine greater than 97%. Plus cloudiness, which can be caused by a variety of materials in the water. Plus it improves taste and odor.
Okay. And the price of this today is what, $179, I believe, isn't it? See, I'm out on the road.
I believe you had on special for $159, Gary.
$159. The normal price is $259, so it's $100 off today. So if people would like to take advantage of the water, the Gary Null water filter system, it call 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065. We have 17 in stock. They're handmade, by the way. And this is considered by many the finest water filtration system there is. And all the science, all the studies we have on hand to verify all the claims. It's been tested, university tested, laboratory tested. So if you want to drink some clean water, then this is the filter to use. Thank you, Roy. We're out of time. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Let's say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Today we're talking about Haiti wanting international forces that have been in the country since 2010 to leave. We're talking about the silence of Nigeria's super rich in the face of the national crisis and the latest wrinkle in Ed Snowden's spy game.
Excellent. We're looking forward to it right now.